Hello and welcome to Peck Underground Church. I, of course, am your host, Josh Peck. We have a very exciting guest and a very exciting topic for you today. I'm thrilled about this. So our guest is Derek Gilbert. I've known him for years. We worked together at Skywatch TV, and for at least the past couple of years, he's been talking about this upcoming book, Bad Moon Rising. So I've kind of been with him through his whole thinking process, and we've started off a lot of mornings at Skywatch talking about this, and it's just fascinating. Fascinating subject matter. But before we get to that, I want to remind you real quick why it's important that you go to Josh Peck Disclosure and become a member. Because if you're able to catch this live, that's awesome. I hope that you're able to view it now. We're getting some people talking in the chat already, so that's great. But as soon as this live stream is over, unfortunately, I have to make the video private and then download it on my own and put it on my own website. Because especially with a topic like this, YouTube will just flat out delete it and then it'll be gone forever. So you want to go and become a member at joshpeckdisclosure.com. That name is changing, by the way. Very soon, it's going to be dailyrenegade.com because we're adding a whole bunch of new shows, and it's going to be a whole platform for hosts such as myself and some others. But just go to joshpeckdisclosure.com, become a member. It's a lousy $10 a month or $100 a year. That one is actually the better deal because then you get 2 months for free. Either way, it adds up to less than a cup of coffee a day, so it's definitely worth it. But you get exclusive content you can't get anywhere else because it keeps getting censored. So you get full versions of Peck Report, Peck Reports that have never seen the light of day on YouTube because YouTube would just delete it. You get the full archived versions of Peck Underground Church. So you'll be able to get this full video and it'll be up there forever. So you'll have access to it and be able to watch it later. All right. So without further ado, I want to welcome one of my best friends in the world, very, very, very close brother to me, Derek Gilbert, author of the forthcoming book, Bad Moon Rising. Let me get the subtitle here. Islam, Armageddon, and the most diabolical double cross in history. It's no wonder that YouTube would censor this immediately if we give them the chance. So, Derek, how are you doing?
I'm doing amazing. And first, Josh, I can't tell you how delighted we are, how thrilled Sharon and I were to hear the news about Nathan. I'm finding that as I get to the age my dad was, when I really began to understand that my dad wasn't as dumb as I thought he was, that he began to get more emotional about stuff. And I thought maybe it had something to do with the fact that, he suffered a mild heart attack at, a few years younger than I am now, bearing in mind, of course, that a mild heart attack is one that happens to somebody else. But I think as you get to a certain age, you begin to realize how important certain things are, and family and children are at the top of the list of things that are important. And so hearing that Nathan is in remission was just an amazing thing. And I can't tell you how many people came up to us and told us that they were praying for you and Christina and Nathan and Jackie and Adam and Lily. And so congratulations on adding a fourth. Now you've got a whole quartet, which is awesome too. So
yeah, you're going to have to teach them how to sing because I have no clue. Well, thank you. So that really means a lot, too. And those prayers have definitely paid off. I mean, the doctors were amazed at how fast he went into remission. So for those who aren't able to follow us on Facebook or who haven't heard of this, so Nathan, my son Nathan, had leukemia, and we rushed him down here to Memphis, Tennessee, to St. Jude's to get him treatment. And we just found out, we just found out that he has no trace of leukemia in his system anymore. He is in remission right now. We still have to stay here for another month or so for more treatments to make sure the cancer doesn't come back. But even the doctors, the power of prayer is amazing, because even the doctors were just amazed that it went into remission as fast as it did. So it is absolutely a miracle. We are thrilled about it. We threw a big party for Nathan in our little hotel room, and we had a lot of fun, and we're thrilled. Nathan's happy, and so I want to thank all of you out there for keeping us in prayer and especially keeping Nathan in prayer. Those prayers definitely pay off. So thank you all so much. Yeah, it's amazing stuff. Yep. So,
as you say, this is a book that Bad Moon Rising is a book that I've been working on for a little while. And I mentioned this at the Hear the Watchman conference, because I didn't talk about this particular topic, but it seems that whenever Mike and Jeannie invite us to another conference and I come up with a new talk, it turns out to be the outline for a new book. And that's kind of what happened here. I want to say at the outset, whatever the censors at Google or YouTube might think, notwithstanding, this book is not about bashing Muslims or bashing Islam or bashing the Prophet Muhammad.
Right.
It is first and foremost about the reality of the spirit realm, the unseen realm, as Dr. Michael Heiser, you know, titled his book, which is kind of foundational to all of the work that we've done, you know, the last few years.
Yeah.
But in thinking about Islam and realizing that surveys consistently over the last couple of years show that current trends continue for the next 50 years, Islam will be the largest religion on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. By about the year 2070, 2075, there will be more Muslims on Earth than Christians. Now, why is that? And I think there are a couple of reasons, which I didn't delve into the social reasons behind it in this book, because I think it's more of a spiritual cause. Islam has been around for almost 1,400 years, and it is now stronger than ever. Whereas when you look at the course of history, a lot of religions have come and gone. The pagan religions of the ancient Mesopotamian world, gods that have had a good run and then just kind of faded away for some reason. I mean, what is Zeus today except another, you know, movie character?
Right.
Thor, you know, he's a Marvel comic character. So why is that, where Islam is not only still thriving, but growing, and again, will become the largest religion on Earth within the next 50 years? So I went back and started looking at it, and I noticed that when you look at the spread of Christianity after the resurrection of Jesus, after the first century, when the apostles went out and began to preach and teach across the Mediterranean world, then took it to India. There's evidence that some apostles or missionaries reached China as early as the 4th century AD, okay, mm-hmm. 300 years before Islam. Essentially, Christianity became the dominant religion in the known world. I mean, the Americas, you know, excluded, of course, but for most of the rest of the world, Asia, Europe, and Africa, Christianity was the number one religion in terms of, at least in terms of the what we would call, I guess, I don't want to use the word civilized because that's demeaning to the people of Africa, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, but the Roman world, let's put it that way, the Roman right. and Persian world. By the time Muhammad came on the scene in the early 7th century, Christianity was the dominant religion. Mm-hmm. Why then did Islam suddenly just explode out of the Arabian Peninsula after his death in 632 AD? And within 100 years, it had basically overrun most of Eastern Christendom to the point where, you know, the reason we call the West today the West is because the East, which were the inheritors, Roman culture, civilization, language, art, literature, was basically destroyed by Islam. How did that happen?
Yeah.
Well, when you look at the spread of Christianity, the one place that really, where Christianity never really took root, close to Israel, close to Jerusalem, was the Arabian Peninsula. So why is that? So I started looking at the gods of the Arabian tribes after the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and found that the most popular gods there were essentially the same gods that had been worshipped in Mesopotamia going back to, you know, 1,000 years before Abraham. Mm. So my theory in this book, and I try to make the case, that Islam is essentially the spiritual equivalent of a corporate merger, that the old gods of Mesopotamia were caught by surprise by the resurrection. And the Apostle Paul makes this point in 1 Corinthians 2, verses 6 through 8, where he says the rulers of this world, the archons, and I think in the context he's talking about the principalities and powers, you know, the spiritual entities that are our real enemies, not the human faces of this spiritual movement. I think that, as Paul wrote, if they had understood what was happening, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. They would not have sent Jesus to the cross. But they didn't know what he was trying to do. They didn't understand it. And so they helped him complete his mission. And then suddenly, realizing what had just happened, they banded together, put aside whatever differences or conflicts they may have had between themselves, because I think you can make a good case that these fallen angels fight with one another. as well as fighting with God. I mean, look, they're going to take on the creator of the universe. Why wouldn't they fight one another for control here on Earth?
Right.
I think that has a lot to do with the history of warfare here on Earth. Anyway, they put together a religion that is essentially the antithesis of what Jesus Christ taught. Mm-hmm. And I kind of lay that out in the book, show how the history of Islam manifests the characteristics of the old gods of Mesopotamia, the god that I call the god, Enlil, El, Dagon, Baal, Hamon, what has gone by many different names over the centuries, the storm god, Baal, otherwise known as Satan, the sun god, the moon god, very important. And of course, that's not a surprise because you got all of those crescent moons on the minarets over the Kaaba in Mecca. And a couple that people might not expect, the war god, although that may seem obvious, but I'm talking about the war god who was the national god of Moab, Chemosh.
Oh.
And the plague god, Reshef. And,
right.
Oh, yes. And of course, the goddess of sex and war, Ishtar, who's a key member of this coalition. And then I show how I think this is all going to play out in the end times. I mean, this is all interesting history, but unless we show how it's going to affect us in the world today, it's, you know, just a historical exercise. And I think any end time prophecy or any study of end times prophecy that doesn't account for the world's largest religion or the religion that will be the world's largest in the next 50 years is missing a really big component. So I talk about what I think is going to happen as we get closer and closer to Armageddon.
Yeah, definitely. That's been something I've been interested in for a really long time, the role that that Islam will play in end times prophecy, because there's a lot of different ways that people have looked at that question, especially today. I definitely want to get into that, but before we do, there's a lot of things on the internet, you know, about Islam, a lot of misconceptions, and then a lot of a lot of things that we should really be worried about and keep our eye on as well. In researching for this book, what were some of the most surprising things that you discovered about Islam today, and what are some misconceptions that people might have about it? Because I mean, we're certainly not. You are more than I am, but I'm certainly not an expert in Islam. I didn't find out till just recently that there was a difference between the Quran and the Hadiths. So, what are some misconceptions? What are people missing here?
Well, I think generally speaking, we in the West, again, there's that term, the West, which is only the West because of the wars that Islam waged against the East, is our history.
Yeah,
and the fact that we have had a long history of warfare initiated by the followers of Muhammad in the 7th century AD. And yet we and academics in the West seem to think that we of European descent are really responsible for all of this, that somehow Islam's antagonism, its animosity towards Christendom was caused by the Pope, who in 1095 AD said, hey, we need to take back the Holy Land, forgetting that by that point, Europe had been attacked repeatedly for 400 years before the Pope finally said, let's go back and, you know, get Jerusalem back. Now, were the Crusades handled in a, you know, completely ethical way? No, many of the Crusaders went for the opportunity to kill people and steal stuff. And many Jews suffered at the hands of the Crusaders as well. Okay, all that aside, the fact is, it was 400 years in coming before the first Crusade set out for the Holy Land. What really surprised me was learning how quickly Islam overran lands that had been predominantly Christian for more than half a millennium.
Yeah.
I mean, Jerusalem, you know, Israel, after the Bar Kokhba revolt in the second century, when the Emperor Hadrian kicked out the Jews, there was a kind of a vacuum there. After Christianity became accepted in the 4th century and then the official religion of the Eastern Roman Empire, the Roman Empire under Theodosius the Great, Christianity spread, and the earliest centers of Christian learning were Jerusalem and Damascus and Antioch and Alexandria in Egypt. And within 50 years of Muhammad's death, those were all Muslim. They'd all been overrun and taken by Islam. Within 100 years of Muhammad's founding, or Muhammad's death, rather, by 740 AD, Muslim armies had taken over Persia, Pakistan, most of the stands, all of what we think of today as Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Israel, Lebanon, most of Turkey, all of North Africa, and all of Spain. And it was only because of Charles Martel in France, you know, the king of the, or he was actually the mayor of the palace, leader of the Franks, defeating a Muslim army at Tours, which if you look at a map of France, that's like halfway to the English Channel.
Mm-hmm.
How did this happen? And how did we forget that the Islamic armies had taken that much territory in such a short period of time? Constantinople, which was the capital established by Constantine the Great in the 4th century, it essentially became the capital of what was left of the Roman Empire after the Western Roman Empire fell in the 400s. It was besieged by Islamic armies in 674 for 4 years, in 717 for 2 years, in 1390 for 12 years, in 1411, 1422, and again in 1453 when it was finally captured. But Vienna, Austria, and again, look at a map. Look how far away from lands that we consider Muslim Austria is.
Yeah.
Vienna was besieged by Muslim armies in 1529 and again in 1683. 1683. The Spanish had a colony in America more than a century before that. The English pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock in 1622, and yet 60 years later, Muslims were at the gates of Vienna and would have taken it if not for the Polish king Jan Sobieski, who literally rode to the rescue at the very last minute. So, you know, this is something that we have not been taught in the West. There was an island off the southwest coast of England, the Isle of Lundy, that in the 1690s was captured by Muslim pirates for a couple of years, and they were raiding the English coast. I mean, basically, Europe was raided by Muslims for more than 1,000 years.
Wow.
And we in the West have forgotten this, and it's part of their religion. In 1786, before George Washington was elected president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams were absolutely gobsmacked that our Navy, our merchant ships that were trying to sail into the Mediterranean and, you know, just for business, were being captured and enslaved. Our sailors were being enslaved by Muslim pirates, the Barbary Coast. You know, and they asked the ambassador from Tripoli, why are you doing this? We consider all men our friends. We've not done you any harm. What's going on here? And the ambassador from Tripoli told Jefferson and Adams, who were brilliant men, essentially said, you're not Muslims. So Quran says we can, you know, take your stuff and enslave your men. That goes all the way back to Muhammad. That's how Muhammad turned a little ragtag group of followers into an army that built an Arabic empire. In fact, there are some scholars that go so far as to say that the whole phenomenon of the Viking raids, you know, the Vikings who terrorized England and Ireland and Scotland for centuries there in the 900s, 1000s, the whole practice of Scandinavian Viking raids was instigated by a demand for white slaves by Muslims.
Wow. In other words,
the Vikings were trying to fill a demand for slaves. And one scholar wrote a book back in just 15 years ago called Christian Slaves, Muslim Masters. He's a professor at Ohio State University, estimated that between 1530, okay, so the time of King Henry VIII in England, until 1780, King George III, time of the American Revolution, during that 250-year period, he estimated that Muslim pirates in the Mediterranean enslaved more than 1 million Europeans.
Wow.
And yet you never hear any of this. Now, again, the point we have to remember is that the people doing this are doing this at the behest of principalities and powers and cosmic rulers of this present darkness, these entities that I identify in the book, the old gods of Mesopotamia that were trying to, I think, accomplish two things. And I hope I make this point in the book. One was to try to put a stop to Christianity by killing as many Christians as they could. But secondly, and this is where the end times aspect of the book comes out, I think Islam was created specifically to lure Jews and Christians, if we're still here when the Antichrist emerges on the scene, into worshiping the Antichrist as the Messiah. So I think this is just a long game played. But again, the entities that are playing these games live a whole lot longer than you and I do. So they can, you know, make plans that last a little longer. From our perspective, you know, this kind of thing seems crazy, but like I said, they've got a different perspective than you and I do with our limited human vision.
Yeah, and that's a good point too. We got to keep in mind that the people that are following this religion and doing these you know heinous acts throughout history, they're deceived. You know, they're deceived. Right. You could think of them as prisoners of a war that they don't really have a full grasp of. You know, the true enemy, like you pointed out in Ephesians 6, the true enemy is the principalities and powers behind all this stuff, which is why. Which is why knowing our faith, having reasons for believing in Jesus, you know, having all that, knowing how to, if we ever have the opportunity to actually speak with a Muslim person, knowing what arguments to bring up, knowing about their religion so we don't come across as just totally ignorant, you know, that's so important because you can convert a Muslim to be a Christian. You know, Nabil Qureshi was one of the most, I think, one of the best examples of that before he tragically died at a very young age from stomach cancer, I believe. But
shame, yes.
Yeah, I mean, he was, he was a Muslim. He found Christ. So, I mean, it's not impossible. It's very, and he turned out to be one of the biggest evangelists of our time. I mean, amazing guy. But it's through understanding where they're coming from, understanding their own beliefs, and also understanding our own, so we can have a free exchange of ideas and actually show that no, Jesus Christ is the way, and here's why, and here's where. You know, and we do this out of love and respect because, again, they're our enemy. So we're supposed to love them, but we still hold firm to the truth and say, well, you know, out of love, here's where logic kind of falls apart in these areas of what you believe.
Right.
And that can be extremely beneficial. So getting to the end times aspects of this, because there have been a lot of different interpretations on how to read certain, prophetic Bible passages. You know, there's the revived Holy Roman Empire view of eschatology. There's the Islamic view. There's, some people believe that it's going to be more of a Jewish state expanding and enacting the Noahide laws onto the world. And there's that view, like the Jewish Antichrist view. So what led you to what were the most convincing points in Bible prophecy and the look at what Islam is doing today and how it's growing and how it's functioning today? What were the strongest connections between that and Bible prophecy that you brought out in the book?
Well, first things first, to give credit where it's due, two guys who really got me thinking down a different track from, you know, more traditional analyses of end times prophecy. Chris White, who has been way too quiet lately. Chris, if you ever see this, we'd like to hear more from you. His exposition on the book of Daniel was really helpful, but also his book False Christ.
Yeah.
And his book on Mystery Babylon, in which he believes Jerusalem fulfills the requirements to being Mystery Babylon. I disagree with him there. Mm-hmm. That's where I tend to agree with Joel Richardson. And Joel Richardson, who's written the best-selling book Mideast Beast, where he makes a case for a Muslim Antichrist. Joel, you're wrong about that one. But Mystery Babylon, in which he makes the case for Saudi Arabia and Mecca in particular as being Babylon the Great, I think he's right on. And that, so I kind of took pieces of what both of those guys put together, and I think I've come up with a plausible scenario for the end times. I think we're going to look at a very devastating war. Obviously, you know, Armageddon concludes with a war that brings the whole world against Israel.
Yeah.
And this, in my view, the most plausible trigger, I think, would be a regional war similar to the Psalm 83 war that Bill Salas has written about, where the nearby Muslim neighbors of Israel are drawn into a conflict with Israel. As Chris White pointed out, Daniel 11, the last six verses of Daniel chapter 11, verses 40 through 45, read like a chronicle of the wars of Antichrist.
Yeah.
And he, I think, made a really strong case there. And of course, I don't have the verses up in front of me, but the king of the north figure that's identified there, I think there are a couple of ways of reading those passages. You read about a king of the north, a king of the south, and then a he. And I think that he is a third figure in there, and that would be the Antichrist. But according to those verses, just to summarize, he wins a smashing victory over the enemies of Israel and then pitches his palatial tent between the sea and the glorious city, which is Jerusalem. But then he falls with none to help him. Well, if you compare that against the description of the beast in Revelation 13, where one of the heads of the seven-headed beast appears to have a mortal head wound, but he recovers, and people are amazed and just astonished. And then, who is like the beast? And everybody worships him because of the miraculous recovery. This, interestingly, fits together with Jewish eschatology. And again, credit to Chris White for this, or pointing this out, because Jews are expecting two messiahs, Messiah ben Joseph, who will fight the war of Gog and Magog. And that, and I'll talk about this more in just a second, but the war of Gog and Magog, Ezekiel 38 and 39, is the war that concludes with the Battle of Armageddon. And I'll explain why in a minute. So Messiah ben Joseph fights the war. He dies in the war. And then Messiah ben David arrives and revives or resuscitates or resurrects Messiah ben Joseph. Or in some beliefs, Messiah ben Joseph is resurrected into Messiah ben David. And then Messiah ben David defeats the nations, judges the nations, and then casts the nations and their angels, the 70 gods of the nations, into Gehenna. So this now, from a Christian perspective, we look at this character in Daniel 11 and the character who the beast in Revelation, and we know, okay, that's the Antichrist. Jews, however, are looking for this figure who leads Israel to a victory against its end times enemy, Gog of Magog, and then is miraculously resurrected. That's their Messiah.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's where we get this fundamental difference between what Christians expect in the end times and what Jews expect. Now, again, approaching this from trying to fit what Muslims expect in the end times into this became the key here. And this is why I think Joel Richardson is correct in identifying Mecca and Islam as mystery Babylon. He points out, and he makes a really good case, that the money that has flowed from Saudi Arabia and through Islam to the West since the discovery of oil back in the first part of the 20th century has really seduced a lot of the political and academic leaders, even religious leaders, into making common cause with Muslims, or with Islam. Prince Awali bin Talal of Saudi Arabia, one of the wealthiest men in the world, very famously bragged about how he was able to get Fox News to change its coverage of those Muslim riots in Paris a few years ago, because Al-Walid bin Talal is one of the biggest shareholders in News Corp. So there are many universities that have Islamic studies. They are putting in prayer rooms for Muslim students. And I don't have a problem with that per se. But again, when we're going to talk about Islam, let's be honest about what the Prophet taught and what the Hadiths teach.
Right.
Now, there are some who suggest that because the price of oil has taken a dip here over the last couple of years, as America, just here in the last couple of months, officially became the world's leading exporter of oil.
Right, yeah.
Now, I'm old enough to remember the 1973, oil crisis, where OPEC embargoed our oil. There's question of whether or not that was legitimate, but set that aside. The point is that we Americans were convinced that we were just going to be dependent on Middle Eastern oil forever. And now we're exporting more oil than the Saudis, the Russians, and everybody. So does that mean Joel Richardson's theory that Islam is Babylon the Great, this nation that traded and shared its wealth with the merchants and the kings of the earth, does that mean it can't be true? No, what I think it means is that it's exactly what we see in the book of Revelation, that the beast and Satan and the kings of the earth will decide that the Babylon the Great, i.e. Islam, Saudi Arabia, Mecca, is dispensable. We can get rid of it because it will be destroyed, according to the book of Revelation. So if a war erupts in which the nearby Muslim nations go to war with Israel, and this Antichrist figure, who Jews will likely see as their Messiah, the Mashiach, Messiah ben David, wins this smashing victory, Muslims around the world will see this Israeli figure as the Dajjal, which is the Muslim Antichrist figure. And suddenly you're going to see Muslims from all over the world, just as we sort of saw in the Syrian Civil War, where you had Muslims coming from Chechnya and Pakistan and Uyghur Muslims from Western China and American and British Muslims, you know, sneaking out of the country to fight in Syria for the Islamic State. I think you'll see Muslims from all over the world lining up to go toe-to-toe with the Dajjal because they will believe that the end times are here and it is their duty as a good Muslim to fight for the Mahdi when he arrives. And I think what is going to happen is that they will lose badly, that the reason that Islam was created by these principalities and powers, the old gods of Mesopotamia, is to serve as a blood sacrifice to lure and convince Jews and Christians, if we're still here, okay, because I just ignore the timing of the rapture in this book altogether. If we're still here, and there are Christians who would see this figure who wins this smashing victory over Islam, perhaps expanding Israel's borders to fulfill the land promised to Abraham in Genesis 15, may welcome him as the incarnate Christ. So I think that is the role, that's the diabolical double cross that's in the subtitle of the book. I think these fallen entities have created, because from their standpoint, Muslims are already on their side. They're already lost. They don't need to try to win them over to their side. Their only useful purpose in the end times, as far as the principalities and powers are concerned, is cannon fodder. And I think that's what's going to happen. And that suddenly after this, then this man who Jews believe is Messiah ben David, who Christians, if we're still here, believe is the incarnate Christ, goes into the temple in Jerusalem, because there'll be a third temple by then, I'm sure, and then declares himself to be God. And suddenly then it's, what have we done?
Wow. Yeah. It's fascinating to think about how close we might actually be to something like that, too. I mean, there are reports, coming out of Israel all the time now about how, you know, the Messiah is going to be here right at Purim or right after the elections. And, and I've been seeing a lot of that. So I don't know how frequently that happens, though. I don't know if it's like every year they're saying that kind of stuff. To me, it seems more frequent this year, but I might be off on that. What are your thoughts about that? And do you have any candidates that you're looking at as possibly being the Antichrist alive today?
Well, I really don't, to be honest with you. I do think that we're seeing a lot more, I don't want to use the word chatter, but we're seeing more rabbis, Orthodox and Haredi, what we may call ultra-Orthodox, but I guess they consider that a pejorative, an insult, Haredi rabbis who are saying that the Messiah is here. He's already on earth. He's about to reveal himself any day now. Some of them were saying that they thought the Syrian civil war was the war of Gog and Magog. Again, it's just important to remember that the war of Gog and Magog in their eyes is the last battle. And I think they're right, because again, Gog is the Antichrist figure, even though they don't call him the Antichrist, but Gog to Jews is the Antichrist figure. The reason I believe that we're looking at the same war, the war that ends at Armageddon, and there's some confusion there because after the thousand-year reign, Gog and Magog come back, and there's another war when they're finally defeated and thrown into the lake of fire. But remember that Gog is the Antichrist. He's supernatural. It's, you know, not right. The same human candidate. It's not Vladimir Putin, okay? It's not Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey either. It's going to be a human, but he's going to be possessed by an external entity, a supernatural entity. In Ezekiel 28, Ezekiel has a lament over the city of Tyre and talks about how Tyre, which is a city, was a city on the coast of Lebanon back in the day, it's where Jezebel was from, was the leading merchant empire, the trading empire, and it was basically sea trade. They were ocean, basically sailors, the best sailors in the ancient world, the Phoenicians. And they were descendants of the Amorites. And this gets back to the very puzzling comment God made to Abraham when he, made his covenant with Abraham. You know, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. I think that's still true today. Anyway, when you look at Ezekiel's lament over the city of Tyre and its destruction, and how the mariners and the seafaring men and the business captains are lamenting, and they say, you know, who is like Tyre, the great city? It tracks almost exactly with the lament for Babylon the Great in the book of Revelation. It's clear that John the Revelator read Ezekiel, and the Holy Spirit inspired John to draw from Ezekiel for what he essentially, he was shown the same thing as Ezekiel. So you've got that parallel between Tyre and Babylon the Great. And again, Babylon, I should point out, was founded by Amorites, the iniquity of the Amorites. Remember that phrase, memorize it because it's still relevant and important today. Then in Ezekiel 39, after the war of Gog and Magog, there is a sacrificial feast that God describes to Ezekiel that he basically is serving up a really gruesome sacrificial feast for the birds of the air and the beasts of the field, of kings and captains and horses and warriors and, you know, yada, yada. And in Revelation 19, after Armageddon, there's the same thing, where the world, the beasts and birds and beasts are to come and feast on the fallen army, the armies of the world that came against Israel at the Battle of Armageddon, which is the fight for God's holy mountain, Mount Zion, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. So you've got those two parallels there. It's connected to Babylon, the old Babylon, the Amorites, the gods of the Amorites, who are these Mesopotamian gods I'm talking about. And John drew on all of that for his vision in Revelation, or was shown this in his vision that he described in the book of Revelation. It all comes down to the Amorites, the gods of the Amorites, and what they are trying to do with one desperate roll of the dice, their last attempt to knock God off his throne.
Wow. Yeah, it definitely, I mean, it all connects, it all fits together. And I mean, it's just hearing you talk about it over the past couple of years or so, I mean, it fills in a lot of gaps that were previously kind of, you know, mysteries to me, you know, because, you know, again, I've heard a lot of these types of interpretations, but what you present, I assume in your book, I haven't read it, but I kind of feel like I have just from being with you through the process of your research. And then like I was talking about it and everything, but that has filled in so many gaps that none of the other eschatological views, in my opinion, have even come close to. And that's what's amazing about this type of work, is we get to build off of each other's, you know, work. So you were able to piece together some stuff from Chris White and Joel Richardson and, you know, other sources as well. And that's what helps us come to a more complete picture. So, I mean, it's absolutely fantastic that you put this out. I've been looking forward to it for 2 years, so at least. So I'm really excited about its release. Let's do this. Let's go to Q&A. And while people are getting their questions together, everybody in the chat room right now, go ahead. If you got a question for Derek, put it in the chat. We'll go through some of your questions while they're getting their questions together. I know the book is not out yet, but what can they look forward to, and where can they go to find out more about you, your work when the book does come out? Where can they get it, and what's coming up on Skywatch TV having to do with this?
Well, the book will be out officially in July, but we've got some programs coming up on Skywatch TV in May, beginning around the 22nd of May, I think. There'll be 4 weeks of programs on this book and new books by Carl Gallops and Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis. We did that last year where the three of us got together and we did 4 weeks of programs on our books. And so we're, I guess, going to do the same thing again this year. But officially, I should say, it's supposed to be out July 15th. That's the official release date at Amazon, but it's already available for pre-order at Amazon.com, which blew me away because it is the number one new release at Amazon in Islamic theology.
Nice.
And it's all the number one new book in the Islam category as well, which blows me away because I'm looking at these other new releases. It's top 10 in all the books available at Amazon related to Islam right now, which again, it's, I mean, okay, I'm here with, you know, new editions of the Quran and commentaries on the Quran, and I'm flabbergasted. I'm honored. But for people who are interested in pre-ordering, you can go there. But of course, there'll be a special offer from Skywatch TV coming up in May. It'll probably ship towards mid to late June, I think, and then Amazon will get it mid July, I think. But again, somebody must have found the title interesting, and of course, Jeffrey Martis with the cover.
Fantastic cover. You know, it's funny. The same thing happened with me and Steve on Second Coming in the New Age. For a while, it was tracking number one in like paganism or something like that.
Yeah. I wonder how long that's going to last there, and I wonder how much attention we're going to attract by getting this book up there is so high in a category devoted to Islamic theology. As I'm certainly not, and let me say this, I'm not an expert in Islamic theology, eschatology, or history. I just try to read as much as I can from scholars who are, and credit to fellows like Raymond Ibrahim, whose new book, Sword and Scimitar, is excellent. Tom Holland, In the Shadow of the Sword. Dr. Timothy Furnish, who's written a couple of books that I recommend, available as Amazon Kindle editions, Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate, great title, and 10 Years Captivation with the Mahdi's Camps, which is also a play on an older book. But those men have really helped open my eyes to some of the key things related to Islam. I mean, there's some fundamental differences between what Sunnis believe and what Shias believe, and who they expect to see as the Dajjal, their Antichrist character, who they expect to see as the Mahdi. And I think this is key to understand. But I would direct people who really want to deep dive into those subjects to the works of Raymond Ibrahim, Timothy Furnish, especially, because they're the ones who've got their degrees in this stuff. I'm just trying to piece together the puzzle, and their work has been really helpful in doing that. My website, for people who want to follow what is going on with me, is DerekPGilbert.com, and of course SkywatchTV.com, where we're posting all the video links that of the stuff that we do. And by the way, we're really looking forward to getting you back in studio.
Oh, yeah, me too.
So this is, I think, a topic that really needs to be addressed. But again, I want to stress, and kudos to Joel Richardson for this. He told me about an outreach initiative that a friend of his came up with all of the people fleeing the violence in Syria over the last 4 years, especially. A group got together on some of the routes being used by the refugees, and they set up phone charging stations so that people who were, on the march, just walking, trying to stay in touch with family or relatives, could charge up their cell phones. But while they were doing it, they were saying, "Hey, look, we've got this little micro SD card, and we can let you have this. You can store pictures or whatever. But there's also a book on it that we'd like you to read if you get time." And most of the people are happy to take, whatever, 16 gig, 8 gig, micro SD card or whatever, but it has a Bible on it.
Yeah.
And so they were giving away hundreds and thousands of Bibles, but by doing it, by offering a service in love. Right. They weren't preaching there, unless people started asking questions or whatever, and maybe open some witnessing opportunities. But the main thing is, like, look, you're human, we're human, and as followers of Jesus Christ, we're here to say that, he loves you, and this is how we're going to show this to you. So that's really the approach. And it's difficult to do when people are marching under a banner of that represents 1,400 years of war against people who don't follow the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad.
Yeah, very true. And we recently had Joel on Peck Underground Church. Of course, can't find it on YouTube because we talked about Islam. So, but if people are members at joshpeckdisclosure.com, they can get that full interview. But absolutely fantastic story and testimony and ministry, really, because,
right.
Those are the people we want to turn everybody to Jesus, as much right. as we can, but especially just in the geopolitical climate today. I mean, those are the people that I think could really use it. But again, of course, everybody can. Well, let's move into Q&A. We have Jay Davila Ashcraft with the first question. Derek, how do you think the Kaaba is linked, if at all, to the Watchers and or Nephilim?
Jack, I know where this is coming from. And this is actually something that's in the book, and I spend some time on this because one of the other things that was really intriguing about the research for this book was discovering that in all likelihood, the original Kaaba was not at Mecca. It was, in fact, most likely at Petra.
Oh, okay.
The evidence for Mecca before about the year 900 just does not exist. Archaeologists who've done digging and are honest about it will say, we just don't find any evidence of anything at Mecca prior to about the year 900. In fact, the first reference in any text outside of Muslim sources that makes mention of Mecca is dated to about the year 741 AD. Now, remember, by that time, Islam had already overrun the entire ancient Near East. Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Kuwait, Persia, Afghanistan, Armenia, all of North Africa, Egypt, Libya, over to and all of Spain. And you're going to tell me during that 100 years, not one European said, why are these guys, what's this religion? Where are they from? What is this thing at Mecca that is making these people come out and just, you know, come to war against us? No. And that one mention in 741 AD had Mecca in completely the wrong place. So there's also no evidence that it was ever a wealthy center of merchant trading. I mean, it wasn't even on the caravan route, okay, from South Arabia, where all the spices and incense and stuff was brought to port at Gaza and then shipped around the Mediterranean. They would have had to go out of their way to get to Mecca. That's not where you want to put a trading station. You know, you want to put it on the caravan route.
Right.
Now, Petra, on the other hand, was there. Anyway, in 1869, Sir Charles Warren climbed Mount Hermon and said that he found the temple at the summit of Mount Hermon, the highest place of worship on the planet, found an inscribed stone there that said, those who swore an oath proceed from here. Oh, by the order of the most high and holy God, those who swore an oath. And it's a reference to the watchers. Mm-hmm. But he also found a low stone spiral, a wall that forced people to approach the summit with the summit on your left-hand side. If you were trying to get to the summit to pour your drink offering into the summit, it was scooped out for that purpose, you had to approach it with the summit on your left-hand side. Well, the Kaaba in Mecca is always circumambulated in a counterclockwise fashion. It's always on your left.
Right.
Now, if, and there's evidence that I present in the book, there's a reference to a cube that was worshipped in Petra from the 4th century bishop named Epiphanius from the island of Cyprus. And how they would circumambulate this cube. Although he misunderstood the Arabic word, he thought it was the word Kaaba, which means virgin. He thought they were worshiping a god born of a virgin. Oh, they're trying to copy Mary and Jesus. No, they were worshiping a god of the Kaaba, a god of the cube. And at Petra, in front of the temple of the main god of Petra, a god called Dushara, there was a cube that apparently held a sacred stone. And according to a Canadian historian, and I'm not going to mention his name, even though he gets credit for this, he's concerned because he's trying to reach out to Muslims too, and he doesn't want any association with Christian ministries to perhaps make it more difficult for him. So, you know, I just want people to know this is not original research to me, but he believes that during a civil war, during a transitionary period around 680 AD, one of the last surviving companions of Muhammad basically took the black stone from the original Kaaba and Petra and moved it then to Mecca to get it away from the caliph in Damascus. So, but Sir Charles Warren, in describing this ritual, pointed out that according to Muslim tradition, there were stones from five sacred mountains in the Kaaba. One was the Mount of Olives, another one was Mount Carmel, another was Mount Ararat, one was Jabal al-Nur, which is supposed to be where Muhammad received his visitation from Gabriel, and one was Mount Hermon.
Mm.
So, again, it's interesting that you've got this connection to Mount Hermon in Muslim tradition, and this tradition on Mount Hermon of having to circumambulate the summit of Mount Hermon to present your offering. Now, is the black stone in the Kaaba, which is on the eastern corner, did that come from Mount Hermon and these other holy mountains? We don't know. But the evidence points to it originating in Petra. We know, according to the 4th century Bishop Epiphanius, that they were worshiping the cube at Petra, a god in the form of a cube at Petra, 300 years before Muhammad. And it seems to point back to Mount Hermon. And who knows? Did it originate with the Watchers?
Wow. Yeah, it's fascinating to think about. Yeah, there's this rich history there. Rock and Roll is asking, what about the Sanhedrin planning to sacrifice a red heifer on the altar they sanctified last year on Passover this year? What are your thoughts about that?
The news that they had found and certified a perfect red heifer was released in September, last September, and they've not been any news on this since then. We've been watching very carefully for this. It's got to reach 2 years old before they can do it, so it wouldn't be until 2020 at the earliest. They are probably being quiet about it because there are probably groups out there that would like to damage it in some way and render it unsuitable for the sacrifice. But we are reaching a time when the move towards actually building a third temple is coming to a head. In fact, an Israeli politician, Moshe Feiglin, just this past week said the time to build the third temple is now. Feiglin is challenging Benjamin Netanyahu for votes among conservative Israeli voters. And we know that he's got a strong interest in the third temple. So we'll see. There are certainly forces behind the scenes, the Sanhedrin and other religious Jews who want to make it happen sooner rather than later.
Yeah, time is drawing short for sure. James Mansfield is asking, were Adam and Eve in love? If so, since love covers a multitude of sins, and then there's a question mark there. I'm trying to extrapolate a question out of there, but
Timothy Alberino made a really interesting point, and this may be a bit speculative, but he suggests that because the account in Genesis 3 says very plainly that Adam was present when the Nakash, the serpent, tempted Eve, that Adam, realizing what Eve had done by eating of the fruit first, willingly ate the fruit, knowing that he was condemning himself too because he didn't want to live without her. So is that possible? I suppose so. Mm-hmm. But certainly we don't see anything in the scripture that said that they didn't love one another. So,
right. It would stand to reason that they probably did. Well, yeah. Thank you for the question, James. Wendy is asking, what about the city called Neon that Saudi Arabia wants to build? I believe from what I had found that they want to bulldoze Mount Sinai and put the new city there. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that assumes that Jabal al-Laws is Mount Sinai. I doubt that they'd want to do that. I think they would rather, if Mohammed bin Salman is behind this, he probably wants to exploit it for tourism. In fact, there's another Nabataean city similar to Petra in this area that they would want to develop and exploit for tourism. I love Joel Richardson like a brother, but I don't think he's correct about that theory. I don't think the Mount Sinai is at Jabal al-Laws. It's too far away from Kadesh Barnea.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and that in itself is an interesting conversation. I love reading about all the, you know, different theories about that, and you know, reading what Joel has to say, and yourself and Mike Heiser, and I love the conversation. You know, just the idea of thinking what it could be. It's fascinating. Baobao is asking, what do the two horns on one like a lamb represent in Revelation 13? In your opinion, can't wait to read the book.
The two horns of the lamb in
Revelation 13.
That's a good question, and I'll be honest with you, I really have not thought about that.
Okay. Yeah, not a problem. I wouldn't know. Yeah. All right. Barbara Britt, I don't know if this one is for you, but we'll what is the name of that documentary showing this Mecca? I forgot the name, but it's very good.
Yeah, this is the Canadian historian that I talked about. He's got a documentary called The Sacred City. The Sacred City. And he actually goes so far as to point as he researched all of the existing mosques, the oldest surviving mosques in the world, because every mosque has a what they call the direction or the Qibla toward Mecca built into one wall so that all Muslims know which direction to kneel when they pray. You know, which direction, so that they make sure they're praying their prayers toward Mecca. But the Quran points out that around the year 624 AD, Muhammad changed the Qibla. Okay, so this is about 2 years after the Hijra, where he got kicked out of his home city and had to travel to Medina. He changed the direction, and according to the Quran, it's because word came to him from the Jews that they were mocking him. He didn't know the direction to pray until we told him, because he had originally been praying towards Jerusalem.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So in 624, he changed the Qibla and changed it, and everybody assumes that it was towards Mecca. Well, this historian went with GPS and architectural tools and satellite photographs and found the oldest surviving mosques on Earth and the 12 mosques for which he could determine the Qibla prior to about 730 AD, so the first 100 years of Islam after Muhammad's death, and not a one of them point to Mecca. And none of them point to Jerusalem either. They all point to within an average deviation of 2 degrees which, you know, out of 360, that's pretty small deviation, about 2.5 degrees difference off of Petra. I mean, as far away as Canton, China, Guangzhou, China, there was a mosque there built in the 630s AD, and it points at Petra.
Wow.
And then after that, after it began to shift away from Petra, there was some apparently dispute between, okay, who's going to control Mecca? Which direction are we going to point the Qibla? And so some of the mosques that were built out in the West, out in what is now like Tunisia and in Spain, they don't point to Petra or Mecca or Jerusalem. They are basically parallel with a line drawn from Jerusalem to Mecca or something like that. It's really weird, but it's not what Muslim historians are taught. It's not what most of us have ever heard. But again, the oldest mosques seem to suggest, again, that the direction of prayer, once it was shifted from Jerusalem, was shifted to Petra.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a lot more than a coincidence.
It's worth watching, by the way. The Sacred City, it's available on Amazon Prime. And if you've got an Amazon Prime subscription, you can watch it for free.
Fantastic. Let's do one more. Our Seth McVeigh, actually, this guy is going to be producing some videos for this channel. Like I've told people before, you want to be a member. You want to go to Josh Peck Disclosure and be a member because we're bringing on a lot of shows. Seth McVeigh hosts an excellent interview show. Derek, you've actually been on his show before. It's called Apollineering. It's a mixture of apologetics and engineering. He's agreed to actually, well, for a trial run to just see if we like the arrangement and everything, but we're going to try it where he's going to move the show onto our platform here that we're building. And so for all of you guys, go and become a member and subscribe to this channel and click the bell. So you're going to get his show, but I'll give him the final question here. Hi, Seth. He's asking, how does Islam eschatology relate to biblical end times prophecy? Great question.
Well, Muslims are expecting the arrival of a Mahdi. Now, Sunni Muslims, and this is the key difference between, one of the key differences between Sunnis and Shias. Sunnis, about 90% of the world's Muslims, they expect a religious, devout Muslim man to arise as the rightly guided one. That's what Mahdi means, who will lead the forces of Islam to glorious, victorious global jihad over the rest of us. This is similar to what Jews are expecting of Messiah ben David, Messiah ben Joseph. A devout, religious, observant Jew will arise and, you know, fulfill. Whereas we Christians are saying, well, look, Messiah ben Joseph was already here. You know, Jesus, the son of Joseph and Mary. We're just waiting for Messiah ben David to come back. And when he does, he'll be all out of bubblegum. The Shias are very much like that in that they are waiting for an imam, a religious leader who they believe is in occultation or hiding, sort of like the legend or myth of King Arthur, where Arthur was mortally wounded in the Battle of Camlann against his son Mordred, and was taken off the battlefield and sent to the island of Avalon, where he will be mysteriously kept in stasis until Britain's greatest hour of need. That's kind of the idea that Shias have of the imam who will return. Now, Twelver Shias are the majority of the Shias. That's the branch taught by the Ayatollahs in Iran. But there are Sevener, there are Fiver, there are other sects within Islam. Islam has as many sects and disagreements over end times prophecy as we Christians do. So just putting out a blanket statement saying this is what they believe, anyone who does that is really oversimplifying it.
Right.
Shias are expecting a supernatural Mahdi to return, and Sunnis are expecting a human who is devout, religious to emerge, and then from there basically lead the forces of Islam to victory, and basically wrap things up from there. Similar to what Jews believe, where Messiah ben David will judge the nations and then usher in a period of peace and justice and love on earth. It is curious that you've got that difference between Shia and Sunni Islam that's very similar to the difference between Christian and Jewish expectations of eschatology.
Yeah.
One group is looking for a human savior, where another is looking for the supernatural savior to emerge. I'm also guessing that if But here's my take on this. I don't think it really matters who they think the Mahdi is going to be, because I don't think the Mahdi is ever going to arrive. Mm-hmm. I think if a Mahdi candidate were to emerge, and here's the thing, among Sunni Islam, because any human who feels he can make a case for being the rightly guided one to declare himself the Mahdi, there have been a number of Mahdis over the last 1,400 years, and they leave a trail of bodies in their wake. In fact, Dr. Timothy Furnish, who's the expert on Islamic eschatology that I mentioned earlier, has been warning about the rise of a violent Mahdist movement since 2005, almost 10 years before the Islamic State declared the caliphate. And he's not a prophet, it's just Tim can read history. And so this has happened before, it will happen again. And it will happen again until Jesus comes back. But I don't think the Mahdi is ever going to get here. I think the emergence of this Antichrist character who will present himself to the world as a Jew. I'm not saying he will be a Jew. There is a big distinction there. He will present himself to the world as a Jew. He, of course, will be seen by both Shias and Sunnis as the Dajjal, and they will be tripping over each other to go to war with him. And like I said, they will be slaughtered, sacrificed. It will be horrible.
Yeah. Well, we're definitely living in sobering times, for sure. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and doing this. I mean, for the audience, this was totally unplanned. Like, I literally texted Derek like a couple of hours before the show and said, hey, something actually opened up. I might actually have an hour to do an interview. You want to do one? And he was happy to do it. And so I appreciate you taking the time to be on the show and talk about your new book. Have you done interviews on this book before?
Or this is the first one. In fact, I turned down another one earlier today because I said, well, the book's not going to be out till July, so why don't we hold off and wait until after Skywatch TV has a chance to do something on it? But I am going to be talking on this book tomorrow at a church in Joplin, Missouri, Southside Trinity Apostolic Faith Church in Joplin at 10:45 a.m. is their morning service, and then again at 2 in the afternoon. So all of this stuff was top of mind today, so the timing worked out perfectly.
Oh, fantastic. So yeah, people are in the area. They should go check that out. And and yeah, make sure you subscribe, click the bell here, because you get to hear it first here. Like Derek just said, this is his first interview on his new book. So, well, we're thrilled for your book to come out. I can't wait to get a copy. Like I said, I've been looking forward to it for a couple of years now. And thank you again for coming on. One last time, what is your website? Where can people follow you?
DerekPGilbert.com, or for Sharon and me, and of course, our weekly Bible study, GilbertHouse.org, GilbertHouse.org. That's kind of a hub for all of what Sharon and I do. A lot of this research, by the way, is going into Sharon's novels, the Red Wing Saga. You know, we didn't even get into the whole, you know, return of the Rephaim thing at in Ezekiel 39, which I think is another key component of the whole end time scenario. But we're working on a book this fall, the two of us together, called Profiling the Dead, and that'll be a key part of that book. So,
oh, we'll have to have you guys on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sandbag, something to talk about later.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, hang on the line. I'll close this out here. So that was Derek Gilbert. Make sure you check him out at the links he provided. Real quick, thank you so much, Thribulous Z, for your generous $12 contribution to through Super Chat. He's saying, I'm sad that I missed the show. I'm signing up for your website, brother. Hey, I tell you what, before you do that, because you're a moderator, you help this channel out. Email me, I'll give you a free membership. And that's actually something else that we're trying to do, because we know not everybody can afford a membership. It's not my most favorite thing in the world, having to charge for content. It's only because of the censorship issues. So anybody, if you can't afford it, but if you can afford some time and you want to write some articles or something for the website, anybody who contributes to what we're doing here, you'll get a free membership that way. So you can email me for more information on that, and I'll be talking about that more. But joshpeckdisclosure@gmail.com. If you're interested, write me a 2,000-word article on a topic of your choice that you think would resonate well with this audience. Send it to me, and I'll be happy to take a look at it. And then for my moderators, if I haven't done so already, email me and remind me, and you'll get free memberships too, because you're working for this ministry. It's the least I can do. You should be able to have access to what the ministry provides that you're working for. So, all right. So, but that's why everybody else, you should go and become a member. We got good things coming up, some amazing, exciting things. The future is looking bright, and I can't wait to see what God is going to do with this ministry and with all of us as individuals. So thank you all so much. Thank you again, Derek, for being on. Until next time, this has been Peck Underground Church. Love you all. Take care and God bless.